Right, okay, guys. Tonight, very lucky to have Emma Dabiri. Very warm welcome to the LSC. Emma is many things, as we're about to find out. Cultural commentator and also somebody who does research and teaching at SOAS, which is School of Oriental and African Studies, which is just up the road, from the LSC. And I'm going to start, though, by playing a clip from a programme that Emma presented, or is presenting, for the BBC. It's a series. The BBC is obsessed by history and costume drama, making people dress up. And they've had a fantastic series of series where they try and get people to go back and live in the past. And they did this for Brixton, which we've mentioned before, you may remember, as a really sort of iconic community for Black Britons. And so I'm going to play you a clip from Back in Time for Brixton. I'll do the beginning and then I'll zoom forward to a bit in the middle, just to give you a flavour of some of the work and issues that Emma's interested in.
Meet the Irwins. Janice.
Oh, I'm in heaven.
Weininger. Tiana.
Do people actually eat these?
Brianne.
I thought you said rats.
Shalassa and Romaine. They're going back in time through 50 years of Black British history. Starting in 1948, they'll discover how post-war Caribbean immigration changed the way we all live. From leisure to work.
Any more fares, please? Any more fares, please?
Music to sport. And how it all started in one London suburb. The Irwin family live in Dagenham, East London.
Well, it's not very nice, is it?
I guess nice isn't the first word that springs to mind, no.
I mean, it's sort of shabby and smelly. Why?
Well, you have to remember that there's an incredible housing shortage. The war hasn't been over for very long. There's very little accommodation that's available. What is available tends to be in kind of this really, the state of disrepair.
So they've basically got one ring to cook on, one sink to wash in. They're all just crammed into here with, you know, not a lot in the way of facilities.
And while that might seem quite shocking to us, they're actually really lucky. Many families would have had access to the same kind of just very limited amenities, but they would have had to share them with the entire house. So they might have been out in...
So other families living in...
Other families. So it would have been like communal. Also, it's quite a hostile environment that a lot of Jamaican arrivals are coming into, and there is intense discrimination. And as a result, lots of people just won't rent to Black tenants.
Census data shows just how quickly the population of Britain was changing.
Basically, population. We can see in 1951 that there are 43,000 people here from Commonwealth countries. Mm-hmm. And then by 1961, there are 101,000.
So and then there's been a huge colonies, jump. It goes up from 21,000 to 85,000.
Exactly.
So why would they want to come?
Well, if we think about the Caribbean specifically, there's a significant shortage of jobs at the time, and Britain has this huge labour shortage.
Which is basically rebuilding the country after the war, presumably.
Exactly.
Right, so we'll stop there. Please welcome Emma Dabiri.
Hello, everyone. Okay, I'm going to talk for about 10 or 15 minutes. I'm going to take you on a bit of a whistle-stop tour through quite a broad landscape, but then you guys can ask me questions when I'm finished, and we can kind of develop some of the ideas through that. So the topic that I was given to kind of frame this via was post-colonialism. So I'm going to talk about the post-colonial landscape, the relationship of that to the media, capitalism and identity and identity politics. So it's quite a lot, but it's just like a little kind of taste. Okay, so obviously there's been at the moment, they're just every day there are just bombshells in the news. There seems to be so much happening. We're living in just like incredibly. They feel like very historic times as we're living through them. So obviously Fidel Castro just passed away, and that's kind of the end of an era of post-colonial leaders. He was one of the last that are alive, and he survived a lot longer than most of them had. So I'm going to start by kind of speaking about some of those leaders and what their kind of relationship to the media via the post-colonial landscape. I'm going to start with a quote from, I'm Irish, as you might be able to tell from my accent. Ireland just had the centenary of its independence now in 2016. One of the leaders of the 1916 Rising, James Connolly, who was another one of these post-colonial figures, I'm going to just quote from him. And he said, "If you remove the English army tomorrow and hoist the green flag over Dublin Castle, unless you set about the organization of the Socialist Republic, your efforts would be in vain. England would still rule you. She would rule you through her capitalists, through her landlords, through her financiers, through the whole array of commercial and individualist institutions that she has planted in this country and watered with the tears of our mothers and the blood of our martyrs." So I'm now going to speak a little bit about Franz Fanon, another who I'm sure you're familiar with, but another one of these kind of great, like iconic post-colonial thinkers. Franz Fanon was I assume you guys know who he is, but if you don't, he was a Martinican psychiatrist who was very involved in the Algerian War of Independence and also in kind of like the metaphysics of blackness and ideas. He wrote a book called The Wretched of the Earth, which is like a classic post-colonial text, and also Black Skins, White Masks. He was also kind of resolute in this idea that the Third World, as it was then called, needed to follow this socialist path and create this idea of a society based on the principles that man or woman, people, are the most precious assets that there are. And everything then has to kind of develop on from that central premise. The most important thing in our society is human life. Okay, well, we know this is not the way that the post-colonial landscape has evolved by any means. If we look at what became kind of independent sovereign nations following colonialism, we see that generally across the globe, societies and economies are organized according to the logic of the free market and neoliberalism. So unlike Fanon's vision or James Connolly's vision or Castro's vision, man is only valuable insofar as he can be a productive worker or a productive worker slash consumer, generating more capital and further expanding the reach of the market. So to think now a little bit about, the agendas of different media, I've been very interested in how the responses to how Castro's passing have been covered. So obviously a complex figure, but his nonetheless, Castro's vision essentially represented this ideal of a world without capitalist imperialism. However, a lot of the coverage of his death and the long years that he was in power hasn't really foregrounded that, as the more critical coverage, of which there's been a lot, but rather it's really emphasized the human rights abuses that occurred under Castro. For instance, one that I've heard referred to frequently is his treatment of homosexuals in the 1950s and 1960s. This is interesting to me because when we think about British values, for instance, as they are valorized and they are taught according to the national curriculum, There doesn't seem to be this emphasis on the treatment of homosexuals in this country during that same period, bearing in mind that homosexuality was illegal here, punishable by imprisonment until 1967. So, or for instance, we could think about what was happening with the British in Kenya at that time and the alleged atrocities that the British government were committing against the Mau Mau revolutionary freedom fighters of Kenya. So it seems that often within the media, there's an ability to talk about certain countries or certain countries without much context and focus on the kind of liberatory democratic nature of those countries. But in other contexts, it's not necessary, it's not possible to have those conversations because we tend to focus on the human rights abuses that might be occurring in other instances and examples as well, but for some reason don't get covered by the media. Okay, so there's been a huge shift in media use over the last 10 years, but it's really amplified, I would say, over the last five. The Pew Research Center found that 62% of Americans get their news from social media. I don't have the figures for the UK, but I would imagine it's very close to that. So this is quite revolutionary in terms of how we access media information. The internet and social media more specifically has provided us with previously unimaginable opportunities to kind of interrupt dominant media discourses and also to voice issues and stories that until recently have never really been afforded coverage. Okay, so like just an example of this and something that I have spoken widely about and I'm in the process of writing a book about would be debates around black hair, for instance. Like black hair is this really powerful lens for examining social and historical processes relating to many things. But it's the type of topic that until recently wouldn't have been published in a mainstream publication because you would just be met with the type of resistance of, oh, that's too niche, that's just very superficial, da da da. But people having access to the technology of social media kind of alerted mainstream publications to the reality that there is a wide audience for these stories. And because people just had that autonomy to disseminate these stories themselves, we start to see more mainstream platforms picking up on these. This has been, so this is powerful and alluring in many ways. And also the appeal of this content to people who've had little meaningful engagement with issues that involve or concern them should not be overestimated. Likewise, the normalizing of minoritized people's stories and achievements is important in complicating what are often one-dimensional and dehumanizing tropes that often kind of dominated in the media and would be further used to marginalize certain groups of people. As a result of these developments, I would say what could be described as beautiful communities have formed, developed, and expanded even offline, often as a result of this online interconnectivity. I personally have had the pleasure, joy, and stimulation of meeting like minds across continents, the type of people that it was maybe difficult for me to access before this rise in social media. But this isn't as straightforwardly positive as it may, or not that it's not positive, it's just more complicated than it may at first appear. So I've just returned from South Africa, which was eye-opening, my first time in South Africa, which was eye-opening in many ways. But initially, upon landing there, I was struck by how many people I met who knew people that I knew from here and from the US and from other parts of the diaspora. It was quite remarkable. So in that context and in others that I've been in, it can often feel as though actually the world is full of kind of like-minded, progressive, creative, radical souls who are dispersed across the globe but are increasingly coming together through space and time, often through this interconnectivity of social media. However, when I kind of went off piste and ended up in a situation with people that I hadn't intended to. Something happened and I ended up somewhere that I hadn't intended to. I was really struck by the sensation that when I moved beyond the people that I knew, who knew people that I knew, many of these associations that were forged by online relationships born out of shared interest and born out of shared interests, I realized in a way how niche and non-representative a lot of my interests and beliefs are, but that the world I've constructed for myself would have me believe quite the opposite. Now, this is reinforced by the fact that not only my online world, but also my physical material world is increasingly made up with people that I've connected with online. And it suggests that a lot of people think as though I do. And it's this sort of blindsiding which led to the shock and surprise, first of all, I would say in my experience with the general election, then with Brexit, and most recently with Trump's win. However, my own cluelessness at the result of the UK general election caused me to kind of take stock of this phenomenon. And despite my carefully curated online world, suggested that maybe my view wasn't as representative as I thought. So when Brexit happened and also when Trump won, I was unsurprised, I'm sad to say. So if we look at the medium through which this technology is kind of being accessed and used, we think about our smartphones. I'm sure, is there even one person in this room that doesn't have a smartphone? I'll be really impressed. I can see a number of you on them. Anyone not have one? Yeah, we're all infected. There's no information technology ever that has had this depth of knowledge of its consumers. Information is penetrating every waking moment of our lives in a way that is completely unprecedented. There's also never been any type of information technology that has a greater capacity to respond to and tweak our synapses to keep them engaged. We are constantly being given what we want or what it is imagined that we want. And it becomes rather difficult then for other opinions, thoughts, and perspectives to penetrate this. But what we have to remember is if we are making our world look the way we want it to, there are many others out there doing the same thing. And there may be far more of them than there are of us. Their vision might be quite chilling, and it might be, I would go as far as to say it might even be threatening to our very existence. So there was the recent kind of furore over an article written by a journalist called Abby Wilkinson. I don't know if anybody came across it, but it was shared a lot on social media. It appeared in The Guardian, and it was called "We Need to Talk About the Online Radicalization of Young White Men." This case is worth, the kind of drama that unfolded around this article is worth considering for a number of reasons. So first of all, in terms of the article itself, it's very valuable in that it addresses the potent identity politics that are operating around a lot of young white men, mainly at the moment, and the poisonous toxicity that is emerging therein. The article treats this phenomenon of radicalization of primarily white men, younger white men, in the same way as the radicalization of young Muslims is treated both in the media and in terms of policy responses. And as such, the issues raised in this article are timely and urgent. The events that unfold around the sharing of this article, though, are also important for other issues that are opened up. About 3 days before the article was published, a young Southern African woman called Siyanda Mohutsiwa, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing her surname horribly, so forgive me, and if anybody can correct me, I'm open to that. But she has a large following and a decent-sized platform as well that is similar to the author Abigail Wilkinson, who wrote the article. But she had posted a thread on Twitter that showed a lot of very similar arguments to what became the Guardian article. Now, this caused a big Twitter storm, and then a number of think pieces emerged crying foul play. The idea was that Wilkinson, who's a white woman, had appropriated the labor of this black woman who'd put these arguments out kind of through the non-official channels of Twitter. So the idea was that Wilkinson had seen these, kind of taken that work, not credited it, and been paid to write this article for The Guardian. Wilkinson argues that similar ideas emerge from different places at the same time, which we all know to be the case. So there was this kind of conflict and this kind of crying of plagiarism going on about this article. So what I found extremely interesting is, while there is undoubtedly an issue with underrepresentation of minorities in the media, I think it's worthy to note that the volume of people who chose to take this opportunity to focus on that issue, of underrepresentation of minorities in the media, rather than to pick up on, advance and multiply the conversation about the frankly horrific rise of the far right. So the identity politics of white supremacy are terrifying to me, but we live in a society in which all of us have been conditioned to treat our identities as discrete, sacrosanct entities based on the liberal principles of individual rights. To further demonstrate this, I'm going to quote from John Rutherford, who's written extensively about identity. So, quote opens, "Questions of identity and meaning have been the site of historic struggles against racism, misogyny, and homophobia. But once defined by the new social movements as emancipation from the prejudice and constraints of the old order, identity has now been co-opted by the commercial market value of individual rational choice. Identity has become a more privatized and individualized affair, increasingly defined by social standing and the purchasing of status-giving positional goods. The value of positional goods diminishes as more people acquire them, creating a spiraling of consumption as people strive to maintain their status and identity. This makes identity entangled with commodity relations and the processes of capital accumulation." End quote. At the beginning, I identified how these processes of capital accumulation actually kind of run in a way that's antithetical to the liberatory vision of a lot of the post-colonial scholars. And yet, what I want to ask you and what I would like you to think about is, do you see the contradiction that might exist there? So revolutionary post-colonial thinkers such as Frantz Fanon or James Connolly warned us that the path to liberation could not be achieved through capitalism. And yet the virus of neoliberalism has wormed its way into our contestations, into the very ways in which we organize against oppression. I have no fixed answer or conclusion to this. I would just urge you to think about and to consider the ways that paths which might seem progressive might in fact be complicit in the architecture of our own domination. So I will finish there.
That's fascinating, and it brings in quite a few threads that have woven their way through some of these talks. That sense of identity, especially in relation to social media, the way that it can, we've thought about, you know, this idea of filter bubbles. Mm-hmm. And if you like, what happens if you don't have a, whatever you want to call it, rational discourse, you have a more of a so-called post-truth, more emotional response, more of a personal identity response driven or facilitated by social media. And I just wondered whether you think, because you put it in a very good historical context as well, I wonder, it's a very big question, but to what degree do you think that social media is kind of reinforcing this focus on, well, partly on identity, and partly even in that example you gave about the Wilkinson article, about it wasn't even about identity per se, was it? It was about a kind of politics of contesting who even has sort of ownership of that identity, which is kind of ironic when that identity is being performed on, you know, corporate websites like Facebook and Twitter and so on. Do you think it's the kind of, in other words, do you think it's the fault of those platforms, or do you think actually we are at a phase of whatever you want to call it, cultural community politics, which had actually got to a contradictory point where, you know, the fact that we were so obsessed by personal identity, and that was starting to contradict itself anyway, so that we may or may not like Trump or Brexit, but in a sense, this is to do with, you know, an historical failure for that kind of identity politics to engage. So that's an incredibly long question. Were you with me on that? Should we blame, is it history or is it social media? Let's put it like that. Because you obviously think that something's gone wrong.
Our psychology is such that it's very seductive and luring and easy to think in these them and us type of terms. But I think that tendency that we have is not in all societies or times something that is encouraged and inflamed. I think social media very much has the tendency to amplify those already existing identities. And as I was saying in the presentation, they sort of start to seem the be all and end all to us, because we don't really the world, according to the algorithms, the way everything is framed, we don't often meet anything that really challenges us anymore. So we start to believe that our worldview or our own identity is in some way, I think everybody starts to think in this very individualized way that doesn't lend itself very well to cohesive society.
But not just individual, is it? It's also individual as an identity, you know, about color, race, often very sort of physical things. You know, are you a millennial or not a millennial?
Yeah.
And therefore, somehow you're therefore not allowed to speak, or you feel that you're not allowed to speak on social media.
Yeah, it is very complicated and also contradictory, because there's this idea of kind of individual rights to express your identity, but those identities then also tend to be group identities. But I think what's problematic is, so I teach African studies at SOAS, and I look a lot at pre-colonial African societies. I mainly focus on the Yoruba, well, who now are known as the Yoruba of southern Nigeria, but they weren't the Yoruba before colonialism. But the idea that identity didn't really operate in the same way in these non-European contexts, rather than there being these discrete and rigid binary identities, people were organized in a way that there were kind of overlapping and contingent affiliations, which would shift and morph according to the circumstance. And I think there's a lot to be said for life organized, societies organized in that way, because so much that emerges from these very discrete, binary, contesting identities, it's a surefire recipe for conflict, because it's always pitting people as in these them and us kind of type adversarial ways. I'm not suggesting some sort of return, but I do think it's encouraging to know that we also see, I think, identity in this very discrete, almost immobile way. We see that as this quite foundational concept that we can't emerge or escape from. But we have to, I think, realize that it's a relatively recent historical construct. And there, if I think if we look at societies that were organized in different ways, that can kind of provide some sort of, well, at least we know that it's possible for there to be other ways of being.
And of course, the history of immigration, if you were a black Briton coming from the West Indies on the Windrush back in the 50s, and then there is a journey that person goes on in Britain, and obviously their kids go on, so that their identity is then morphed. I mean, your identity is quite morphed, isn't it? And in a way, in a strange way, you now say you're in a kind of intellectual bubble. That you were saying that you felt that you're in a kind of liberal, multicultural, intellectual bubble.
It's definitely like transnational and global. But it's when I realized how kind of unrepresented, because it seems as though it's like self-evident, because everywhere I go, no matter what country I go to, I tend to like fall into those circles. So I'm just like, oh wow, this is everywhere. But it's not. I guess it's representative of this kind of like almost curated world that has in a way been facilitated by social media, exchanges and relationships.
Yeah, exactly. And last question, and then we'll quickly go for questions from these people. Just last thought, thinking politically, it does seem a strange position, perhaps because of the coincidence of the US election and Brexit. We've got the Labour Party in the UK having a conversation which I don't quite understand, which is saying that we somehow have to stop thinking about identity politics, because we have to somehow win back the working class vote that went to UKIP, which I find odd, because UKIP did very well out of identity politics. And the same with Hillary Clinton, that she's accused of going on too much about gender and about race.
Yeah.
And she lost because, and yet, funnily enough, Trump partly won because he banged on about the identity, particularly of Mexicans,
Exactly. So it operates as though if any minoritized group talks about themselves, then that's identity politics. But if kind of the most hegemonic group also frames its entire existence in the same language of identity politics, that's not identity politics, because that's just the default kind of normal way of being. But you're absolutely correct in saying it's like, oh, we have to disavow identity politics in order to pander to white identity politics is essentially I feel how the conversation seems to be going, rather than any attempt to actually maybe like dismantle the logic of these socially constructed identities.